It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as a large field of Republican candidates continue to vie for the party's presidential nomination, one figure looms large over the group, Ronald Reagan. We'll look at Reagan's rise and what his legacy means to conservatives today.
With John Boehner's resignation and the debates viewed by millions of Americans during the past couple of months, it seems pretty clear that the Republican Party is home to a host of varying opinions.
But amid the disagreement, there's one figure who can, for the most part, do no wrong. That person is Ronald Reagan. More than any president before or after him, Republican hopefuls point to Reagan as an example for policy platforms and leadership style.
But how did Reagan, a Hollywood actor who few took seriously, come to be president of the United States? How does his legacy compare with his actual experience as president? And what can we learn about politics today by looking at the rise of Ronald Reagan?
Here with us now is Rick Perlstein. He's a writer and the author of the book The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, just out in paperback. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to join you, and good luck on the pledge drive. I really would not be here if it were not for Wisconsin Public Radio when I grew up in Milwaukee.
Oh, thank you so much. I didn't know you had that connection here.
Yeah, it was really my lifeline, listening to you guys, listening to Terry Gross, and here I am in Chicago.
Well, here you are, and let's paint a picture, a tale of two times. Are there similarities between where we are in the United States today and the early to mid-70s, the focus of this book?
Well, things are not quite as dark as they were then. I mean, if you can think back to, you know, the 1973, 1974, 1975 period, you know, America is the country that had defeated Hitler. You know, it created the first mass middle class after World War II. Suddenly, we've lost our first war, you know, and a total humiliation. Our trusted president has basically revealed himself to be a criminal. The first oil crisis in 1973 sees, you know, this great nation held hostage, it seems, to a bunch of mysterious Arab sheikhs. And the crime was just completely out of control. You had things like Patty Hearst. You had serial killers. And you really had a complete change in the tenor of what it felt like to be an American.
And you write
the rough times now, but not as rough as it was then.
You write that out of those rough times emerged a new kind of politics exemplified by Ronald Reagan. Talk about how politics changed and how he changed politics.
Well, actually, the first change that we saw kind of came out of that 1960s insurgency, and with what I talked about with Watergate and Vietnam and, you know, the kind of humbling of America economically, you began to see a politics in which Americans were really beginning to think hard about what it might be like to behave as if we were not sort of God's chosen nation. You saw a lot of reckoning with America's institutions. You saw a lot of questioning of the idea of America as kind of the world's policeman. You saw a lot of reformist energies and the presumption among kind of the people who were the guardians of conventional wisdom in the mid-1970s were that the leaders of the future were the people who were going to speak to this new chastened mood. And what really Ronald Reagan represented in these years, as he's leaving his two terms as California governor and beginning to eye the presidency for a 1976 run and then a 1980 run, is kind of Reagan giving Americans permission to kind of stop that, what I think, very necessary work was, and just kind of smile through the apocalypse. He spoke of America as basically providential, the city on a hill. Watergate had nothing to do with anything essential about America. He talked about Vietnam as if almost we somehow won, or if we didn't win, it was all because of the perfidy of, you know, liberals who sold us out. And, you know, it was the kind of the politics that saw its first glimmerings with the bicentennial celebration, which a lot of people were skeptical about. They're like, how can we have a birthday party when, you know, America has, you know, been laid so low? And suddenly, you know, everyone had a great time celebrating jingoism and patriotism. And lo and behold, a new politics were being born.
And the Republican Party itself didn't necessarily embrace this new politics. He was analogous to anti-party establishment figures we see today, wasn't he?
Very much so. Ronald Reagan, ever since he entered politics, that was within, in 1966 with his first gubernatorial run, was seen as a joke, as an extremist, as an embarrassment. You know, when he ran for governor in 1966 and won the Republican nomination, the Washington Star, which was kind of the, even the bigger Washington paper back then, said that there was rejoicing at Liberace for governor headquarters. You know, it was just a big joke. And then even, you know, as late as 1980, when, you know, he was running for president against Jimmy Carter, the Carter people were absolutely convinced that he was such a lightweight that if they could just get him on a debate stage with Jimmy Carter, he would so frighten people, either with his extremism or his shallowness or his lack of intellectual heft, that Carter would glide to victory. Instead, what had been a tie going into the last week of election turned into a not only a Reagan landslide, but a landslide for a bunch of conservative senators who, you know, kicked out a bunch of liberals, you know, the George McGoverns, the Frank Churches, the Birch Bayes.
We're talking to Rick Perlstein, author of the book The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, about Ronald Reagan's legacy and its influence even today on the modern conservative movement.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Why do you think Ronald Reagan is such a powerful figure in the Republican Party still today? And do you see similarities between Ronald Reagan, maybe, and Donald Trump? Call 800-642-1234. We're continuing our conversation with Rick Perlstein. He's the author of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan. It's about Ronald Reagan's legacy in the conservative movement today.
We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Why do you think Ronald Reagan still plays such a significant role in the conservative movement? Is that role deserved? Call 800-642-1234. And Rick, let me ask you that. Ronald Reagan today, a patron saint, you have a debate in his library in front of the airplane. Why has he been such a dominant figure in modern Republican politics?
Well, there really is no one else. If you're a conservative and you're looking to kind of presidential figures, he's really the only one to look to. The kind of dirty secret is a lot of the ideas behind conservatism, especially the economic ideas, are not particularly popular. And Ronald Reagan, by kind of adding that kind of charismatic, smiling optimism, especially at a time in which public life was so dreary and so frightening, was able to give conservatives a victory that no one else could have given them. And his legacy, of course, went on for several presidencies. But ever since then, they've kind of tried to find someone who had that same magic. I mean, every 4 years, the Democrats, since 1963, always seem to have the next John F. Kennedy. And we're finally, you know, seeing that, you know, kind of, you know, basically ushered into the past. But Republicans are still desperate to find that charismatic figure. And this year, of course, they're running around like chickens with their heads cut off trying to find it. And the guy that emerges, Donald Trump, has none of this cheerful optimism, especially on an issue like immigration, which, of course, he's made the core of his appeal. He couldn't be more different from Ronald Reagan, who loved this idea of people coming to America as this kind of beacon of freedom around the world. And, of course, then when he was president, not only was Folsom in his very dewy-eyed rhetoric about immigrants, he signed this massive bill, which was called an amnesty, in which he wiped the slates clean for millions of immigrants who had come here illegally. Very, very different from what Donald Trump is up to, and very, very different from all the Republican candidates.
You wrote in a piece recently, though, that there is one comparison. You talked about how people weren't taking Reagan seriously early on, or even right up to the point where he's elected president. Is that a lesson there for how people observe someone like Donald Trump?
Yes, that's very much more about kind of us as observers of politics than the figures that we're observing. I talked earlier about how when Ronald Reagan first arose as a political figure, and don't forget he'd not only been an actor, but kind of a silly actor. You know, his most remembered, especially by his critics, as the guy who, you know, starred alongside a chimpanzee in Bedtime for Bonzo. And, you know, I trace this tendency we have as kind of know-it-all liberals to dismiss reactionaries and right-wing figures as jokes, you know, all the way back to the 1930s, when Charlie Chaplin, of course, produced The Great Dictator, which burlesqued Adolf Hitler, and he regretted it later because he realized he'd turned Adolf Hitler into this kind of pathetic clown and not someone who had access to kind of the darkest currents of the human psyche.
Let's bring a caller in. We've got Dave on the line in Kimberly. Dave, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm not a fan of Reagan Ronnie, but I think his biggest acting job was that of president. And the reason that the Republicans today, you know, think so much of him is because they have to have somebody.
Right.
Dave, thanks for the call. Rick?
Well, Ronald Reagan had a line about that. He always had a line. He was very great with a quip. And he said, I don't understand why people say, you know, you can't be president if you're an actor. He says, I don't see how you could be president unless you're an actor. and in a sense, there's something to it, right? A lot of what the president does, it's a funny kind of job. Because in a lot of countries, in parliamentary countries, the prime minister, his main role is largely administrative. The symbolic role of kind of representing the country often will belong to a queen or a king or someone they call the president, who, you know, like the president of Israel, say, as opposed to the prime minister of Israel. But the president in America has this role of kind of being the symbolic representation of the American people. And a lot of what he does is a performance, you know, kind of presenting America to the rest of the world. And in the book, I write about how Gerald Ford, in the time in which America was sort of seen as bumbling, was seen as a bumbler. And it wasn't necessarily because Gerald Ford was particularly physically, you know, inept. In fact, he was probably the best president, best athlete we've had of all our presidents. But whenever he would, you know, knock into something, or slip downstairs walking out of an airplane, it was magnified. It was shown on the news over and over and over. And, of course, Chevy Chase, you know, we're celebrating the, you know, the 41st season of Saturday Night Live. On the first season, Chevy Chase became a superstar by basically making Gerald Ford look like Buster Keaton, you know, this guy who was always falling down. And compare that to Ronald Reagan, who, you know, on the cover of my book is balancing himself between two car fenders and kind of ascending up to the heavens. And this ability he had to always be aware of the camera's presence and to present this kind of graceful angle was a big part of his appeal. And I should say a big part of why people who hate him, because he was seen as just a shallow front for interests that he didn't control or understand, and as basically a phony and a fraud.
Rick,
and I demonstrate in my book that he was seen that way even in high school and in college.
Rick, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
That was Rick Perlstein, author of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan, about Ronald Reagan's legacy in the conservative movement today.
The plan by Governor Scott Walker's administration to delay a handful of major road projects could end up costing millions of dollars, according to projections released this week.
The costs, according to those projections, $160 million or more over the next 2 years. Some are calling on the legislature to tap into additional funding to help bridge the gap, mitigate the delays, though it might be a hard sell, especially after a long and hard battle over transportation funding earlier this year.
Here with us now to talk more about this story is Patrick Marley, state government reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So these projects that are delayed, first of all, which roads and projects are we talking about?
There are five major projects that they've said they're delaying for 2 years. It's I-3990 from the state line to Madison, the Verona Road Exchange in Madison, which people in the Madison area are certainly familiar with, Highway 23 between Fond du Lac and Plymouth, Highway 10, 441 in the Fox Valley, which is a big project there, and Highway 15, which is also in the Fox Valley and Outagamie County.
So when we're talking about these delays, does this essentially just boil down to not having the money to complete them in an expedient fashion, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it is. The legislators had a big fight in the budget over how much money to put into roads and how to find money for it. The gas tax and the registration fees that pay for roads aren't keeping up with the schedules that we've become accustomed to for road work. And so and there's been a reluctance to increase those fees and taxes. And so now we're faced with the alternative, which is slowing down the work.
So how slow is the delay going to be? What kind of delays are we looking at?
Well, you know, these projects are multi-year projects that that take 4 or 6 years, and now we're just extending them out another couple of years. So it doesn't mean work stops for 2 years on these projects. It just means that it slows down and the end product takes longer to get. Of course, doing that has a cascading effect because, you know, if a project was supposed to take 6 years and now is going to take 8 years, the next project in line is, you know, just going to start later. And so there is sort of a ripple effect of all of this. And we also have, these are sort of the marquee projects that are being slowed at the moment. There's also what's known as rehabilitation projects, which can be very significant projects. They're also going to be slowed. We just haven't seen from the Department of Transportation what those specific projects will be.
Now, as I understand it, a lot of the projects that you mentioned, work has already begun on them. It's just that it won't be completed. So what sort of state are these roads in as far as driving goes?
Well, you know, it's not. People will just have to get used to seeing the orange barrels up for longer. Many of these projects, you know, are already underway and they will continue. But it's not like the workers aren't going to walk off the job tomorrow. They'll just maybe not start the next phase or slow down work on a particular segment. So the kind of congestion that you have in a construction project will continue. It'll just last longer.
Okay, so let's get into the projections. These delays will cost drivers, according to the projections, $160 million or more over the next 2 years. First of all, tell us where these numbers came from and who's putting that out there.
So this is a calculation made by the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and the Transportation Development Association, which is a trade group based in Wisconsin. And they simply said that, you know, since 2000, the inflation rate for construction projects, for road construction projects, has averaged 5%. So they just applied that 5% a year to the remaining cost for these projects, which is $1.7 billion, and said if you drag them out for two more years, it's going to add $80 million per year. The inflation rate for construction is much higher than the consumer price index just because of the costs for those types of materials, asphalt, and those things have just gone up at a faster rate than other products you may buy.
So then we're looking at more money needed from the budget to pay for these roads because they're being delayed. So essentially the price tag is going up. How do we pay for the delay, the cost of the delays?
Well, I mean, those are costs that are pushed off into the future. So it just means that when we write our next transportation budget in 2 years, which will be a multi-billion dollar project, there will be, you know, just more money that's eaten up by these projects because they will cost more. So it just exacerbates the problem that we're already faced with, which is that we don't have the money available for the projects that we as a state have decided we want to do. So at some point, officials need to decide either we're going to slow down more work and do less, or we're going to increase funding for roads by creating a mileage fee or increasing the gas tax, or some combination of these two, right, where we do a little bit less and we raise some money for roads.
We're talking with Patrick Marley right now, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's joining us to talk about the possible cost of delayed road projects in Wisconsin. And Patrick, as far as I understand it, the legislature could tap into some additional funds to help pay for these projects. So where are we with that, and where would that money come from?
So when they put the budget together, the governor, Scott Walker, wanted $1.3 billion to be borrowed for roads over 2 years. The Republicans who control the legislature thought that was too much, and so they cut that from $1.3 billion to $500 million, a pretty substantial cut. But then they made available this additional $350 million that could be used if the Department of Transportation put forward a specific request of how they would use that money, and then the Joint Finance Committee, which is the budget committee for the legislature, approved its use. The budget was passed in July. Almost right away, the department started indicating that they saw a need for this additional money for these kinds of projects that we're talking about here. And Senate Republicans in particular were surprised that they were talking about accessing that money so quickly and have expressed concerns about issuing any of that additional debt. So there's sort of this internal debate in the legislature now as to whether we should stick with these delays or if we should issue those bonds and fund those roads but have to pay interest on that money since it would all be borrowed.
Now, where is Governor Scott Walker on this right now? You know, as you said, initially he had asked for more bonding than the legislature was willing to give. So what is he advocating for now as far as regards the road construction and the delays?
He met with Senate Republicans today and told them that he would like to see at least some of that money made available, indicated that perhaps there was ways to find savings. He didn't specify where that might be, and would like to at least get some of that money, that additional bonding, rolling. So, you know, if they make that request, if the committee meets, it's likely they would issue some of the money because Assembly Republicans say they support it. The Democrats from both houses support it. So there would be the votes, seemingly, to pass this. But right now the Senate Republicans are resisting calling the meeting at all.
Now, is there any talk of trying to deal with transportation funding outside of the budget process, or is this something that's going to have to be put on the back burner for the next 2 years?
It's a little unclear. I'd say it looks unlikely that it will be dealt with before the next budget in 2 years. The Democrats have said that they'd like to see a special session on road funding, but Republicans who control the show have not been interested in that. And, you know, really, the legislature took a pass on addressing this long-term in the budget. They cut back on borrowing, but they still relied largely on borrowing. They didn't solve the fundamental problem, which is bedeviled legislators from both parties going back for years. I mean, this is a problem of a decade or longer so far.
Now, any chance of revisiting ideas of, say, toll roads or gas tax, given these numbers that we're looking at?
Well, toll roads is very difficult for state officials to get going because you would need to make real money on that. You need to do things like interstates, and you'd need federal approval. So you need Congress to act, and that seems, you know, like a tough sell. It's hard for state officials who want to solve this problem now to rely on Congress for that. Raising the gas tax is something they could do, but one that has you know, there's been strong opposition among many Republicans, and even raising registration fees has been something that there's been big resistance to. Many lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, said that they were open to raising registration fees, but the governor had ruled that out, saying that was tantamount to a gas tax increase and would not support that. And so legislative support for that idea really fell by the wayside quickly because they knew they faced a veto if they were to pass it.
And Patrick, is there any indication of whether voters are going to be upset with this and these delays going forward?
You know, that'll be interesting. I think it's too soon to tell. You know, if you know, at what point do delays have to happen? At what point do roads need to get to a certain condition that voters say that they're willing to tolerate a gas tax increase? I don't know what that point is. I don't know if this gets us closer to that point. But certainly that's something that state officials will be trying to listen to get a sense of if what the public wants, I guess.
And what do you see as the next steps here going forward for both what Governor Walker is asking for and for the legislature?
Yeah, certainly the question, you know, most imminent here is, do they decide to issue this additional bonding to try to put some of these projects back on track, as well as how extensive will these delays for these rehabilitation projects be? Then after that, I think they're in kind of a holding pattern until the next budget, unless some big development comes along.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, state government reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the possible cost of delayed road projects in Wisconsin.